Forever Dog.
Hey everyone, it's me, Ben Blacker, the creator and host of the Writers Panel. Thanks for listening. It's fall. Oh boy, what a fun year it's been, right? I thought I would give a little update because I think my last one was real grim. The good news is nothing's getting better. This is still very much the worst year that many of us can remember. And if you've been listening to the Writers Panel episodes these past six to 18 months, you will hear that sentiment being expressed over and over again. And I guess the good news is that you're not alone. It feels impossible right now. People who should be working are not working. People who are trying to break in, it feels like it's dire. It feels like there's no hope. That's not true. There is always hope. I do genuinely believe that the biggest asset you can have in this business, whether you've broken in or whether, you know, you are continuing to break in, or whether you are just sort of hoping to ride out this current situation, whatever that is tenacity. Tenacity and talent will out. On top of that, be a good person. If people like you, they're going to want to hire you. Do the work, be nice, and hang in there is kind of what it comes down to. I genuinely believe that's true. It's been an insane few years. Like, we keep coming back to talking about how right now it is the worst it's ever been, and that's true. But things have been abnormal since at least 2019, when we had the agency campaign, which was absolutely the right thing to do. And I think we were proven out that it was the right thing to do. But, you know, we had a year without agents, or over a year without agents. And then we had a pandemic, and then we still have a pandemic. And then we have a bunch of new streamers who, you know, are figuring themselves out, along with the existing streamers who are figuring themselves out in a new landscape. All of that creates uncertainty, and that's a tough marketplace. It's a tough marketplace to sell anything in, and it's a tough marketplace to try to get staffed in. I'm thrilled that people are getting staffed. I'm thrilled that people are selling shows. It really makes me so happy to see someone getting their first staffing job on a show when I see that stuff pop up on Twitter. So let me know when that's you. You know, it really makes me feel good that people are getting their breaks. And there's no reason that couldn't be you. Keep at it. That's what we can do. It's going to be a quiet couple of months. I do believe that. There's always a flurry of activity at the end of the year. I'm sure this year will be no different, but it will also be wildly different. You know, it's such uncertain times. But I think, you know, it's going to be quiet these next couple months, and it's going to be difficult to get anything off the ground. So work on your scripts. That's the best thing you can do through early next year. Work on your scripts, get your stuff done. It's what I'm trying to do. You know, we're out with a couple of pitches, and we would love for someone to pick them up. Hey, if you're a buyer and you want to make a movie or TV show, let me know. We have stuff. But mostly, you know, we're getting excited about working on new things. We just keep churning out material because it seems like the best thing you can do, right? It's the only thing you can control. And then, you know, you worry about the market later. Write the thing that you think no one wants to see. I think on a recent episode, we sort of had that conversation that, you know, the shows we were talking about were shows that nobody wanted for years. And that the writer's representative said, don't write this, I can't sell it. Well, that's the thing to write now. Nobody's interested in a down the middle softball. I'm sure some people are, but it's, you know, it's hard to get excited about that stuff. Write the thing you love, write the thing you want to do, write the thing that is your voice, write the thing that only you can write, and then take stuff in, read stuff, read books, read novels, watch TV, watch the weird stuff, watch the stuff that everyone's talking about, watch the stuff that no one's talking about. Just get more input, fuel for the fire. you know, that's why we ask at the end of every episode what everyone's watching on TV these days, because that stuff, you know, is input. Anyway, I thank you for your continued listenership. Do me a favor, please follow me on Twitter at Ben Blacker, and let's talk about writing. I love doing it. I still love doing this show. I think we're up to 500 official episodes, and we're actually well over 500 episodes unofficially. And if you do like the show, please do me a favor, leave a review on iTunes. It's really helpful for getting advertisers, which is the only way we can keep the show going. There's a lot of work involved with the show, especially because we can't go to the studio anymore. And we're just doing this over various interfacing platforms. So we do need to pay engineers and stuff like that. So go leave a review on iTunes, please. That is really helpful. Keep listening. We have some cool stuff coming up. And as always, let me know on Twitter or on Facebook what shows you're watching and who else we should get for the podcast. I'm always looking for great new material to watch and great new writers to talk to. Until that's you. Yeah, that could be you. Come on. I love when I get new writers on the podcast and they say they've been listening to the show for, you know, 5 years. That is incredibly flattering and makes it feel worthwhile. So thanks. Come on the show. Go sell a show, then come on this show. All right. Enjoy this episode. It's a good one.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writer's Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah.
All right. We're doing it. This is how a podcast starts. Prentice Penny, thanks so much for being here. I was saying before, I've been trying to get you for years. This is the dream.
Oh, so kind.
I hope it lives up to my expectations.
Oh God, that's so much pressure. it probably won't, but just kidding. But happy to be here for sure.
Come on. I'm such a fan of yours, and I think, you know, it started with Insecure for sure. That's where I feel like I started seeing your name constantly as a driving force behind that show, which, you know, we can say is a perfect show. Like, really? You guys are coming into what, your fifth season?
Yeah.
Fifth and final season. Yeah. And like, there's barely been a misstep in the process. And I imagine you have an incredible team on that. But let's talk about the early years of Insecure and just like, how did you get involved? Why were you the guy to help bring this to the screen?
Sure. I was on Brooklyn Nine-Nine at the time. And I was on the second season. I was on the first two seasons. And I was a co-EP, so I was definitely ready to either like have my own show or make a move in some way. I think up until that point, I had started my career on Girlfriends, and after Girlfriends was canceled, it was our last season anyway. But the writer's strike kind of made it go faster. But I was the only. I went to what I would say my sort of like white show run, where I was on like a lot of great shows, but I was always the only African-American person. And that just at a certain point became frustrating. It became very isolating. It became just not tough is the wrong word, but it was just like, I didn't understand why we would bring in new writers. And again, it'd be no more writers of color. And so I just was like, I just want to be around Black people again. Like I'm by myself a lot, you know? And I had read that Larry Wilmore was leaving Insecure. He got the nightly show, which was coming on after the Daily Show, and he wasn't going to be there to run it. And my mom had told me about Issa because we're both from the same neighborhood. I think she was like in New York in the, you know how the LA Times was like the LA Times Saturday magazine or something, like the small thin thing. And they did like a profile on her. And my mom was like, do you know her? And I was like, no, I've never heard of this woman. She's like, well, she lives around the corner from us. She's Russian. And I was like, that doesn't mean I know her anymore. But I had seen the web series I was just like, everything that the pilot was talking about were things that I was experiencing in the present or in the past. I had worked at a nonprofit like Issa. I knew what it was like. I was currently the only one in the room, like a lot of Black people in their spaces, the higher up you go. And it just was super funny. And it was unapologetically Black and unapologetically also LA and the neighborhood I also grew up in. So my agent went to college with Issa. And I also knew Lena Waithe, who knew her because Lena and I worked together on Girlfriends. Lena was an assistant when I was on that staff. And she was like, I was like, can you tell her just like to meet with me or whatever? She was like, yes. Yeah. So I wrote her Issa a letter about like why I thought I'd be a good like showrunner for her. What I connected to and that I was here to help, even if she didn't want to go with me, you know? And we sat, we met for like 15 minutes. She was at a book signing and we just started making each other laugh like really quick. And within 15 minutes, it was like, okay, I guess we're doing this. And we definitely did not, we underthought it a lot. We definitely didn't overthink this move. We didn't, looking back, we both said, we probably should have asked each other more questions, but it just felt right in my gut. And it was also a time where creatively I felt, you know, at the time, most of the shows were still network shows. You know, obviously there was HBO and Showtime and that stuff, but certainly the streamers hadn't come on strong yet as content type places. And so you were making a certain kind of show after a while. And I just felt like creatively, I want to try different things, play with tone. And I felt stagnant is not the right word, but that's the closest word that I can describe. And I just, going to do Insecure was a good reminder that we all got into this business to play and to be creative and to have fun without the business stuff can always get in the way. But it was one of the moves where like, I wasn't guaranteed to like run the show just because I did the pilot. I was making a very small, like a super small amount of money. And I was walking away from like a lot of money, you know, certainly, well, and I had a family. So like staying would not be wrong of me to stay to support my family. But I just was like, creatively, I got to like something in my gut is like saying, I didn't know what it was going to be, obviously, but something in my gut was like, you're not having fun being playful anymore. And that was like a good reminder of like, trust your gut and never forget that this is supposed to be fun. And if it starts to not feel like fun, then like something's wrong in the process. And not that it's not hard, but that creative energy, like when you ask a kid who's 4, why he made the cactus pink, he doesn't give you a big philosophy behind. He's just like, that's just what it felt. I don't know. I felt like I wanted to be. And I wanted that feeling again of like being creative without the like thinking things a ton of way through of criticizing myself in the process of creating, which you can do a lot. At least certainly I felt in the network space where you sort of felt like, oh, well, it has to do and it has to that. And you don't even, you're just so boxed in by the moment you're being creative. And I just was like, I want to get out from this for a second. And it was the best decision I made, just even from that standpoint, even if the show had just done one season, because you don't know like what's going to happen when you make your show, right? You can only trust the process. You know, there are so many great shows that just don't see the light of day after one or two seasons, just because of, for whatever reason, it has nothing to do with how good the show and the talent is. Like I often reference Party Down as like such a funny and brilliant show, but just Stars was like, we're not doing comedies anymore. So like, that's not Party Down's fault. It's just like, they're not doing that. You know what I mean? But you look at that cast and who's making that show, people are brilliant. So you just can't control the outcome. You can only control the process. And so that was just a good reminder of like, just have fun in the process.
I think that's great advice for anyone listening too, is like, that should apply to your spec scripts, to your sample scripts, whatever you're working on. Like it has to be the thing that excites you. Yes. You hit on a few things I want to sort of dig into. But one of them is this, like, just 6 years ago was a different time in television.
Yeah.
And I think like shows like Insecure, and there were a few of them at that time, were a little bit ahead of the curve and therefore not a sure thing, in that it has this very distinct voice. It's not a network voice, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't what AMC was doing either.
Right.
Because it's a comedy.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that and like finding the voice of the show, which isn't exactly what the web series was either. It's its own thing.
Yeah, Issa was very clear that she didn't want to recreate the web series as a scripted show. And I think that's what took some time. I think she had been developing it for 2 years at HBO. And I think maybe initially the thought was like letting it be a workplace comedy, but like, you know, she works at the nonprofit and blah, blah, blah. And then I think in the process, Casey Bloys, who's the president of HBO, and Amy Gravitt were like, the stories, and I think Issa would just talk about her friends. And I think in the course of that, in the development process, they realized that the friends and that life is much more interesting than the we, than the nonprofit life. And I think that also, what I think that also allows is that it allowed that Issa's, it allowed for Blackness to be the driver of the story and not how is this woman surviving a white space, right? Which would typically be like, if it was an NBC type show, you would go, oh, that's the thing, right? Not, hey, we want to dive into this other area of your life, right? That is much more rich and things that we haven't seen before. So I think for us, it was always like, okay, you know, once she was clear about that, then it became, okay, well, let's continue to play with tone. Let's like, let it be much more. We always say that like, if with the web series is like high school, then the show is college. It's like, it's a little bit more grown up. It's a little bit more sophisticated. It's much more cinematic, obviously plays with tone a lot more. And because the show is, the series is longer, you know, her web show, every episode would be like 6 to 8 minutes. So there's like so much you can dive into in like that amount of time versus having 28, 29 minutes of screen time. You can tell just deeper and you know, more rich stories. So I think that, and also having a character like Molly, right, which is different than the web series, juxtaposes all of that energy, right? And it does a very different thing. So so for us, it was always about, like, we would reference a lot of, like, Scorsese and Spike and things like that, of filmmakers who made New York, you know, Woody Allen, who made New York, like, come alive as a character. And until that point, at least on TV, certainly on HBO, you had only seen Entourage. So your LA is like, it's easy to make Malibu. That's the thing that everybody knows, Beverly Hills, Hollywood. That's a very, it's easy to make that sexy, right? But we were like, we want to make the same way Spike did Brooklyn and that. We wanted to make our neighborhoods, because typically on film, you see our neighborhoods that, you know, oh, it's a concrete, wherever Black people live, it's a concrete jungle, which is like not true. That's like a specific part of LA, but there's a ton of Black people that live in View Park, Lemur Park, Crenshaw, where it's like working up to an upper middle class, doctors and lawyers that have beautiful homes and beautiful environments. And we wanted to show that part. So that was always our thing, was like, this is the grown up version of that and the maturity of that. So that was always a thing that we wanted to do and continue to play with tone and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, that's really cool. Because it does, like, the reference points are cinematic. And I think the show has a cinematic both look and feel to it, even when the stories can be so small and so personal. Yeah. Were there growing pains in that first season? Yes. Like, a lot of the sort of the structure was in place, right? Like, because the pilot existed when you came on.
Yeah.
But again, you guys didn't really know each other. So.
No, and the pilot is, well, the pilot is also very, like, the pilot is one of the only episodes that has any voiceover. That was in the pilot. And then there's no more.
Oh, funny.
We go away. We were like, we don't want to do voiceover. We tried to cut as much voiceover out in the pilot as possible. But we just needed some for connective tissue. But we knew immediately we were getting rid of the voiceover. So that was one thing. Some of the growing pains in the beginning were just like, from a writing standpoint, some of the growing pains were just like getting our page count right, right? Because you don't really know yet. You haven't filmed it. So a lot of our pages would be like 32, 33 pages of script. But what we didn't realize were like, because we have a lot of moments where it's like, we're creating a vibe, like Issa just walks into the room and just like, oh, reads a book, right? And listens to music or like checks a text. But we're trying to create a feel. So what we didn't realize was like, even though this might be like 1/8 of a page, Issa walks into a room, reads a book, opens a text, is in her feelings, Frank Ocean starts. And that's just like 1/8 of a page. To light that, to film that, takes 3.5 hours. So like, that takes the same amount of time if we had a 3-page scene where characters are just sitting around talking. And that would eat up so much screen time, but it takes the same amount of film time as something that's gonna be on screen for like 30 seconds. So that was one of the biggest things, was like trying to gauge, okay, not knowing at all, oh, this is gonna take 3 or 4 hours to light. Because you're also lighting like one shot and then you're lighting another shot and then another shot, but she's not saying anything. So it's not really eating up page count and screen time. So,
oh my God, yeah.
So that was one of the biggest learning things, was just getting our page count down. Cause then we'd end up having to cut 5-6 minutes, and that's a day. Right. So then you add up all those days, that's like so much, that's, you know, $2 or $3 million, $4 million that we just like wasted. So that was like one thing. you know, just getting our film days down, you know, realizing that, like, I think the first season we were going over, we were always at 14 to 15 hour days. Like, always. Like, I feel, the IASI thing is real. I was like, hey, give them whatever they want. That 100%. That was crazy. But we didn't know. We were just still figuring the show out. A lot of the shows in the beginning was figuring out the writer's room, which was, how much do we like parse out story? That was one of the bigger things in the beginning, was like tone. What stories do we want to see? What's our arc? And so, like, in the beginning, I remember we had like episode 3 was like Issa, which we like episode 3 in this show is a beach day episode where she's like taking the kids to the beach. But in the originally we had, there was a young little Issa that we got y'all. In the kids program, and because she was going through her thing with Lawrence, we were like tethering this little Issa is like also going through something, and it's not until Issa sees little Issa that she's her, and we were just like, we don't want to see kids like that in the show, not at all. So it was like things like that where we would like break, and also it was just trying to figure out like what we were building to. So the arc of the first season was really, she cheats on Daniel was the end of the season, because that felt like the most like, oh wow. But then when HBO heard it, they were like, hey, all the good stuff you guys are doing at the end, move that up, like accelerate that. And we were like, but we don't have anything after that. And they were like, you don't have anything in front of it. This is all treading water. and it was a good, and they were right. You know, they were right. Like it was what we realized was like, oh, she cheats halfway through. Now it's like paint yourself in a corner. Now what's the fallout? And then that became very clear as like the thing, like let's paint them into a corner for the first half of the season and let's deal with that. So if you look at a lot of the like midway points of the season, a lot of them, like in the block party, Issa and Molly have their fight at the block party. That's like so then the second half of that is like dealing with the fallout of that. Season 3, the thing is Lauren shows back up. Okay, now when she's with Nathan, like that's a thrust. So it was always like giving us a midway point to like thrust to the second half of the season. And so that's why cheating on Daniel became the halfway point of season 1. So those were a lot of I think early on we also wrote pops, like flashbacks and pops. And it was like, that's, we had wrote like a few pops of like
funny.
And it was like, you can't even see that now in our show, but like, that's what there were pops. Cause we're like, oh, that's funny. But it just never felt like our show. And Issa was like, these pops don't feel like our show. And I was like, you're right. They don't. But it was just like, we wanted to try stuff, but it was, again, it was to the point of like, let's try, like, let's see, you know, it's like, okay, well, cause we were wrong about voiceover. We knew voiceover. So that it made us just question everything of like, in a good way of like, well, there was voiceover. We threw that out. Should there be pops? Should there not be pops? You know, cause we were just trying to find like, we knew ways it would be dramatic, but we were all trying to find ways to have comedy in the show. And so, but it was also a good reminder, like just because you pitched it, if you try it, it's horrible. Lose it, you know. So it was just a good thing of like, just don't be precious about all your ideas. If it doesn't, it just trust your gut. If it doesn't feel right, and like, fuck it, try something else. You know what I mean? Like, it was just a like not being so tight. It was just a fun.
Yeah,
that first season obviously had a lot of stressors just because we're like trying to get the show up. But it was, I don't think about those things when I think back about the season. I just think about all the fun we were having in the room, and it was just so playful and fun.
Oh, that's amazing.
Tell me about that room. Who populated it? Where'd you find your writers? What were you looking for?
Yeah, what I was looking for was, I think that I had, you know, coming off of my experiences in rooms, I felt that a lot of times it would be like 5 or 6 white guys from Harvard and then me. And I really would always be like, why do we need 6? Could we just do 3 and give like me, and then like maybe hire somebody who's Indian, just like get it, just like take those 3. We got those 3, so we're good. And then like, let's pepper with some other energy.
They were in different houses at Harvard, right, so they have different perspectives.
Right. They were different, right? The Gryffindors and that. And they were all great guys. It's not like a slam that. It was always just, I just knew I wanted like a wide array of things, because for me it was like, when you think about like, this is super corny, but I use it as a reference. Like when you think about the Avengers, there's not like 6 Iron Men. There's like an Iron Man, and then there's like a Black Widow and a Captain America. There's a whole, everybody brings something unique and specific to the team. And that's really what I was like, I was telling Issa, that's what we need. We need different voice. Cause a lot of agents were like, like licking their chops, like, this is my time to send my weird black writers. And I was like, and they would send me, she's like Issa. And I'd be like, I don't need another writer like Issa. I have Issa. I want voices that will be like contrary, but complimentary and also, right? Not reinforcing. That's what I knew I didn't want. Cause I was like, I have Issa. Why do I need like four people that think like her, right? And for me, it was like, and for us, it was like, let's assemble like people that are different than you, like grew up different, raised different life experiences, different economic experiences, different school, different just life experiences. And so we hired obviously comedy writers, but we hired drama writers too. We had like three drama writers. We had, you know, writers who were obviously at various levels, but certainly writers who were gay, obviously straight, single, married, and just obviously different kinds of black women, like writers, like some writers who were just brilliant with story, right? But I also wanted writers that were also looking to be like, give me jokes, like nonstop, you pitch me a bunch of funny things. Then I wanted also writers that were kind of dark and different, because the show has a lot of darker, weird kind of off elements. And also having writers who would be like big idea writers who could just like, when I was reading their scripts, like sometimes like it wasn't done perfectly, but the concept was so like big and like interesting that I was just like, wow, that'd be great to like take the show kind of outside the box, just so people would be pitching other things. And so, and obviously it's not saying that everybody was funny. Like everybody was, had great skills in all those areas. Course, yeah. But for me, it was like, the main thing I wanted was no repetitive voices in the room. So if I felt like I don't look at that staff and go, oh, like Laura Kittrell is just like Amy Aniobi, or Natasha Rothwell is just like Dana Lynn North, right? Or Phil Jackson is just like, you know, Grace Edwards. Like nobody was ever like a copied voice. No person was ever like, oh, they're kind of similar. None. So that was a big thing for me. And wanting just people that were smarter than me, more talented than me, that I was in awe when I read their script, I was like, damn, why didn't I write this? This is brilliant. Like, why didn't I write this? You know? And that was really like how we tried to assemble the room.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's the way you do it, right? Like that's how you get a show with complexity and nuance. It seems to me like looking at the stuff you've done from Insecure, and then, you know, you teamed up with Sam J, and then the stuff that's sort of been announced that you're working on. It feels like there's something in you that wants to help foster talent, and like,
for sure,
you're a good scout. And I think that that's an underrated skill, you know? Tell me a little bit about that and like where that comes from and what you see as your role in those relationships and shepherding projects.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you want to pay it forward, like people like Barb Rockakeel and Karen Gist that runs Our Kind of People and Regina Hicks who runs the Upshaws on Netflix. Like when I was starting out, they just like looked out for me and took care of me, yeah. And put me in positions to succeed. And so my thing is like, I after leaving that show, which I kind of call like my like HBCU experience, where everybody's so supportive of you and wants you to win, that I was by myself a lot. And I was like, I would never want any writers that I can help to have to go through this. This is horrible. And again, great shows, great people. I don't like, look, those are all great moments, but the experience of being the only one, I was like, this sucks and like nobody should have to do this. And so like, that's the blessing of our show, right? Is like, you know, Issa will never know what it's like to be the only black writer in a room, because she just like jumped a bunch of steps, right? By the success of the show. So if I had to go through something so she doesn't have to, or the writers on my staff are getting promoted faster than what I got promoted, that's kind of the point, right? And so for me, it's just always about like, and also I just wanted to that point around Brooklyn, what I also realized was like, you know, life's too short. I just want to work with like dope people, like creative, dope people. And whether that's Sam or Issa or all the writers, like I'm doing various things with, I was just like, yeah, I want to just work with like dope people. And like, cause then dope things will happen. And things will be fun to do. And you have to put the same amount of effort to write a bad script as you do to write a good script, the same amount of work, you know, like you don't know at the time, you're just still doing it. You know, I challenge any person who makes a movie to go, I don't know if this is good or bad. I still got to get up and like, put this 2x up and like, do, you know, it's like the same process. It just, one is good, one isn't, but it's the same process to make. And so for me, it's just like, I just would rather do that. So for me, about like shepherding other voices and being around that is super important. And I think to the point I think that energy, right, lends, I hate talking about myself like this, but I think that energy of like wanting to be around.
That's what we're here for.
But I think the energy of wanting to be around those people takes the ego out to where I don't need to be like the best person in the room or smart. Like that doesn't matter. What matters is like, oh, what's the art that's going to come out of this? So like, so when I'm looking at writers or looking at talent, what I'm looking for isn't how I can shine off of this. I go like, oh, how can we play together? And you know, it's like when two kids meet and they go, you want to play? And you're just like, yeah, because there's no like, yeah. There's no like agenda. It's just like playing is the agenda. And so I think like that in and of itself allows you to see people's greatness without it worrying if it dims your light, you know? And so as a producer, I've tried to just listen to more people that are actually a lot of things about people who are record producers. And I think what I watched this really great documentary about like Quincy Jones, and there's one on Clarence Avon called The Black Godfather on Netflix. And it's really great because it's also an ability to like listen to people and see people and see like, how does that fit together? Like Jimmy Iovine talks about that all the time too, of like, oh, I heard Dre and I was like, or like even people he used to work with, like, I don't know, the Fleetwood Mac or all these, Cream, all these people that Jimmy Iovine worked with like back in the day. You're just like, yeah, I just thought like putting with this thing would like yield something kind of interesting. You know what I mean? And you're just like, I think that's it, right? It's like when I listen to like Quincy Jones, he's talking about just like, yeah, I just like wanted to put this jazz thing with like Michael Jackson off the wall and just see like what would come out of that, you know? Like, and I think that's the thing, right? It's just trying to like try and be willing to play. And I think that in and of itself is kind of what yields the thing that you're talking about.
I love that. I feel like it's so often about like, how can I bring out the best in this person I'm excited about, this idea I'm excited about, whatever it is. And like, what do I have to throw into that?
Yeah.
And I'll try this. And if that works, great. But if not, let's, you know, how do we keep that vision? How do we keep that and get it to the screen or wherever it is?
Yeah, I'm trying, and I think so much of this is like, not even business related. I think I'm trying to like, as a person, as a human being, we're so like afraid, especially things the way now, social media, we're so afraid to like fail publicly. And I've had a failure, like a failure, not even publicly, but I had a failure where I was like fired off two projects, like back to back, right before Insecure. And it really messed with my confidence because I was like, what? Damn, like I got replaced. And like, it really messed with me for like 2 years. And I still did Insecure. And it wasn't that the success of Insecure like fixed it. Because it wasn't about that. It was about me. And it was, I had to like be like, that's kind of not the point. And like, you know, it's okay. Like, that's fine. You know, a baseball player hits 30%, goes 3 for 10, and he's in the Hall of Fame. So like, that's, you know, it's like, so it's not about that. It was just like, yeah, if you give your all to it and it doesn't work out, like, that's okay. That's like an okay thing to happen. And I try to teach my kids that, but I wasn't also living by that. And so I'm trying to like just kind of get back in that frame of mind of like, you try stuff, some things will work, some things won't work, but you just try and to be as creative as possible and leave it on the table.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the best attitude to have, right? But when you're in it, especially when you're younger, like it's so hard. There's so much rejection in this business.
For sure.
There's so much isolation, like you talked about. Yeah. And I don't want to go, you know, too dark, but let's go back to that, those early years. And sort of like finding your way in telling other people's stories, I guess. Right, because that's the job of the staff writer. That's the job of someone who's working on a sitcom. You're doing 20, 25 episodes a year.
Yep.
Let's talk about that stuff and sort of like, it looks like Girlfriends and that was the early.
That was my first, out the gate. Yep, yeah, that was the first. And then I went.
And that seems like it was a great experience.
It was awesome. It was awesome. Like 80% of what I do as a showrunner, I learned from Mara on that show. Because it's like your parents.
I've heard that from other writers too.
She's great. She's amazing. And you know, and it's like your parents. It's like you either, your parents raise you, and if you have a great relationship with them, you either kind of copy what they did, or if you have a horrible, you like go the complete opposite. So it's like your first, you know, because I had writers that started on other shows and they would be like kind of traumatized by that. Like if you're on a show and your first show is like late hours, you just think that's what it is. So you just do it, right? Without even thinking like, do I have to do this? So it was like so much of what I learned was just super positive and super productive. And then I went to, I'm trying to think, I went to a show called Do Not Disturb, which is the first show I went to. And like, your eyebrows furrowing is exactly what America thought as well. How do people watch it?
What was that?
It was the first white show I went to, and it wasn't the show's fault. It was a really great writer, Abraham Higginbotham, who, like, off of Arrested Development and Modern Family, super talented guy. And it was like a small show. It was a show in a hotel. And again, you just don't know stuff, because, like, in between that, it was Jesse Tyler Ferguson was on that show. E.C. Nash was on that show. Dave Franco was on that show. So you don't know, like, you know, and so many great, like, writers, like John Quaintance, Kirk Rudell. It's like so many, like, talented people were on that show, like Elaine Coe, who I think won an Emmy for Modern Family. But it was the first time that I was, like, the only one after a long period. And then I sort of went on a run between, like, Scrubs and Happy Endings and Breaking In, which was like a weird mid-season show that was on Fox, and then Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And then, so that was sort of the run of shows. And to that point, you are sort of like, when I felt, like you don't always know what things in life will prepare you for later. So, like, when I was growing up, when my parents divorced, my mom is a judge. So she grew up very, everybody on my mom's side, super, like, college educated, secondary degrees, very much in that vein. And my dad's side is from Oklahoma, very, like, no colleges, all self-made entrepreneurs, right? So my dad's, when they divorced, my dad was like, I only want him doing things with Black people all the time. And my mom was like, if it's white, it's right. And I want him to do things with white people, because that's how he also has to move to the world. So they had this weird agreement, which was, if I went to a Black school, then in the summer, I had to play sports with white kids or go summer camp with white kids and vice versa. So my elementary school was Black because it was around the corner from my house. And so, you know, we're listening to, like, it's an early rap. So it's like Run DMC, Curtis Blow, LL Cool J, very early rap. But I would go to this white summer camp in the Valley, and I was the only Black kid. And they listened to, like, B-52s and, like, Culture Club and, like, Flock of Seagulls and Kacha Goo Goo. And I was like, I don't know any of this music. And then I had to learn white music all summer. But then I was listening to Black to, like, rap. And so I'd go back to school and I'd be like, hey, do you guys know who the Bengals are? And my friends were like, get the fuck out of here. And that was my whole life for, like, 7 years, was, like, being in one group, always behind. And then when I got to film school, a very similar thing. Like, I was the only Black writer in my film writing program at USC in film school. So I had to learn how to, like, thrive and have success in the same way that I did in the summer camp. And so what you don't know is, like, oh, this skill set, which is a sad skill set to have, but to be able to, like, not be rattled by being the only one and still doing the things you have to do and, like, learning. And all the white shit that I learned, I can apply to these writer's rooms. I'm like, oh, no, I've been to bar mitzvahs and stuff, because, like, that's when all my white friends at summer camp, like, I would go to theirs. And so I was like, yeah, I know what this is. Like, I know this music. I know these references. Like, I know everything you're talking about. I know. But I didn't know, you know, but you don't know how that's. So when I was in these rooms, as like, sad as it was to be the only one, it didn't, like, bug me or bother me. I was like, I'm comfortable here. I'm comfortable, sadly, being the only one. I wish I wasn't, but I'm not threatened by it, or, like, think I'm gonna, like, wilt or not know how to, like, do what I gotta do here, right? And so, but again, you don't know how these, like, life other things are gonna, like, help you in another area. So that's kind of what it was like. So I kind of, it bothered me for different reasons. It didn't bother me in terms of still needing to succeed, obviously.
That's wild. It feels like it's, you know, it's more disappointing than it is, like, than it was personal.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, and you learn so many great things on different shows. Obviously, like, I learned so much of things I still do from all those writers, and I'm still friends with all those guys. So, yeah, those were great runs, but it also opened my eyes up to, like, there's a different world than what conversations when I was on Girlfriends. Like, when I was on Girlfriends, no writer was talking about having overall deals. No writer was talking about pilots. And then the second I got to that world, it was like, oh, should I do another overall deal with this? And I was like, I was hearing conversations I just was not hearing there. And that was like, oh, okay. It was almost like the Negro Leagues in the major leagues. It's like Jackie Robinson getting called up. You're like, oh, okay. There's different conversations I'm hearing and participating in. And then those things start to yield to me, right? It just really showed me, like, once you start to get like those people to vouch for you, at least then. Now, obviously, things are different, but at least certainly then it was like, oh, that's really how I got on Scrubs, was like, I had worked on different white shows, and Bill like asked an exec at ABC, who do you really like? And this guy said Prentice, and that's how I got on Scrubs, which is then how I got Happy Endings, because Jonathan Groff was helping to run that, and he started to run Happy Endings, and he was just like, I didn't even have to interview. He was like, you want a job? And I was like, I like this. This white world is great. Is this what y'all been doing? Is this how y'all get down? This is amazing.
I wish that was the case. Jesus.
So you touched on your parents, and I think it's really interesting. And like, there's something about the hustle of making it in this business and sort of like doing the jobs and trying to meet people and all that stuff. And it sounds like your parents both really had that work ethic. And even if they, you know, sort of applied things in different ways, how did they prepare you, or were you prepared for the like getting your feet wet in this business at the very beginning, right out of film school?
Yeah, I didn't get a job for 9 years. So it took 9 years for me to get my first thing. Some of it was self-sabotage. Yeah. Some of it was like, I'm still figuring out like what I want to do. Like at the time, it was like TV, even when I started, TV was still this way, but it was much more the stepchild to movies, you know. It was the Jam Brady to films Marsha. And so, you know, I wanted to do movies, right? That was the thing, right? It wasn't, and USC didn't offer like a ton of TV writing programs like they do now. So it was like, I think there were like two TV classes. So it wasn't even like kind of a feeder into like, it was like movies, you know? And so, but the way my parents prepared me, I think, is like a lot of African-American parents in America, which is like, you have to work 110% harder than your white counterparts, and that you just do for the same thing. And so that, you know, just sticks with you, and you're just like, yeah, I got to grind this out. Like I watched my dad was an entrepreneur with our family had a furniture store on that side, and my mom was a lawyer who then became a judge. And so like there was no like, no, you're going to college, you're gonna go, like there's no like debate, it's just you, that's what it is. So that was obviously in me, but then you still have, so I would say that prepared me more than anything, that like anything that you want is going to be like, that you really want is a marathon, right? And this business is really a war of attrition. It really is this business will sift the wheat. You know, a lot of people, I talk to people a lot of times, they're like, I want to be a writer. And I'm like, but what kind of writer? Because you can also be a writer where you're at and like write plays and do that. You don't, everything doesn't have to be at this level. And it's not a knock. It's just that it's just the business isn't for everybody. And that's like fair. It's brutal.
Yeah.
It can be heartbreaking. It can be, it's hard. It's hard to get in and it's hard to stay. And so that was the thing in the beginning. I think I was just very, to the point that I was saying earlier about fear, I think I was really afraid in the beginning, and I would work hard enough to make it seem like I was working hard enough to succeed, but I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I was working hard enough to make it have like a nice failure. Because I was really afraid. I was like, what if I try this and I got to be in a writer's room with other writers? And I think, I realized I'm not good enough. Like I'm not talented enough. Like that would just crush me. So I'd always work hard enough to like, just get there and just do enough to like be close, but not like go in all the way. And it really wasn't until my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, was like, what are we doing? Like, there's no plan B. We're going to go all in plan A. So like, you need to get this together. And I did. I had to like humble myself and like go back to like, I took UCLA extension classes about how to write just sitcoms, and I would just write them. So that was embarrassing, right? I was like, I have a film degree, but I got to go back to school and telling people that. And like, I was working as a teacher, so I wasn't even working in my field, but I had to pay the bill. But what it did do was grow me up. It was really like, okay, you got to grow up as a man in a different way than like, then like, you can't do this anymore. Like you gotta be a grown up now, or stop playing, you know, or get out. And so it was a real, like, those 2 years were like, I was like, okay, I earned, you know, I was working at a nonprofit, but I didn't realize, again, to the point of how you don't know, I was like working part-time at a nonprofit, that obviously I didn't know that was going to yield. It yielded me money at the time, but it also yielded me the experience to know what that looks like. And yeah. It was embarrassing to tell people. Like, they knew what I wanted to do, and it was embarrassing to tell people, you know, but it wasn't about that anymore. It was about, if you want it, go for it. It doesn't matter. And, you know, now that seems so long ago, you know, that was almost 20 years ago now. But at the time, you're just like, I got to humble myself and, you know.
And it does feel like, it feels like humbling yourself, yeah. right? Because you're, you know, you're younger, you have great expectations of yourself yeah. and of what the world owes you, things like that.
100%.
It's tough. It's really tough.
Especially when you think that, like, I've done the steps. Like, now give me the mm-hmm. thing, right? Which I think is, like, I try to tell my kids, like, you're not promised anything by doing the steps. What you're promised is that you're learning about work ethic and you're learning this. But yeah. a lot of times we raise our kids to go, you do this, you go to college, you get a good job, you get married. Like, no, that's not true. Like, but it's not until you go through it. So I don't even tell my kids now, like, oh, when you get married or when you, cause I was like, I don't know, maybe not get married. I don't want to put that on them. Like, you know what right. I mean? Like, the way that it was, like, it wasn't put on me, but you just talk that way. You don't really realize how your words have power in your word. Like, I have a friend of yeah. mine who's, like, was his parents were talking about, are you going to be a doctor? You're going to be a doctor. And when he got to college, halfway through, he was like, I don't want to be a doctor. Why am I a doctor? He was like, well, because I was told I was supposed to be a doctor. And you know what I mean? So it's like, but you don't question it as you're going through. You're just like, I'm supposed to get A's and B's and da da da. And what I realized was, like, a lot of times we can also raise people, and I believe I was raised in some of this as to be a professional student, but not to be a thriving mm-hmm. adult. And those things are independent of each other, right? And so, and it wasn't yeah. until I had to do these things on my own, and it was difficult too, because my wife was like a lawyer. She was like making real money and like actually is doing her career. And, you know, it's like, oh, here's my fiance. He's a substitute teacher, but he wants to be a writer. You know, it's like, you know how those things go.
Brutal. The other growing up thing I wanted to ask about is, you know, a lot of my friends who grew up in LA were like so separate from the movie and TV industry. Like, they just had no concept yeah. of it. But it seems yeah. like you were already a fan. And was that always the path for you? Did you know that's what you wanted to do?
I didn't know anybody in the business. I just, you know, you drive around right. and you see people that were like, I think the only connection I had was like my cousin by marriage was one of the Price is Right girls. That was like the extent of like who I knew in the business. So you can count that for what it's worth.
Great contact. It's a great contact.
Great contact. Bob Barker just like, if I could write those bids. I wanted to do, I mean, I loved television growing up as a kid. And I think a lot of it, I was my dad's side of the family, super funny. So it was always around funny people. At the time, my parents were divorced, and my mom would work like long hours going to law school at night. And then my dad we joined custody. So some days obviously I just wouldn't see him. But my grandparents would pick me up. And these aren't like grandparents today where they're like, I'm on Facebook and I'm on Instagram and I'm doing TikToks. It was like, my grandparents were very old school, sit in front of the TV, watch news at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, then, you know, Wheel of Fortune at 7, you know, Jeopardy at 7:30. It was like, we're not playing with you. We're not going out playing catch. Like, we're not doing that. And so a lot of times I'd be sitting in front of a TV, either like I could watch with them or watch in the other room. And so TV was like this other parent or this other like big brother. So certainly that was a thing I was gravitating to, but I didn't, and it really wasn't until Spike Lee used to make these books, and they were, what was great about these books were it would almost be like a journal of like his process of making like She's Gotta Have It or School Days. And then inside the book would be like a script. It'd be like pictures. And it was his whole process from like coming up with it till release. And so you know, as a 14-year-old kid, I'm reading about Sherry Lansing and like all these like people who are like heads of studios, but I'm like, I don't know who these people are, but like you're learning his process of like how he was making the movie. And they were just super like interesting. And I was like, this is like, I went to either be a marine biologist because I loved animals and I love water or a filmmaker. and then I was really like not quite sure until high school. And then a friend of mine gave me this flyer for USC was having like this high school film program for like 2 weeks in the summer. And you got to like live on campus. You got to like make little movies and write little movies with like other kids from around the country. It was like 20 kids. And you got to like be in class with like film professors. And it was like, once I left that week, those 2 weeks, I was like, this is all I want to do for the rest of my life. And that was 1990. I remember that I took that class. And so that was, it hadn't looked back. I was like, oh, you know, fuck those seals. I don't want to do this no more.
I
don't care about the animals
in the ocean. I can't help. There's only so much I can do.
Yeah. What am I going to do? Like BP's got oil. I don't know what to do. I can't do
this. That's really cool. And you were sort of like, it seems like you had the focus to at least like pull the levers to start making that happen. Yeah. Obviously, it takes a long time, but there had been a demystification of the process through like those Spike Lee notebooks, through just watching TV. I think that's really neat.
Especially now.
I want to ask you about directing. Was that always part of it? It seems like that must have been a part of it.
Yeah, film school, I definitely too. Wanted to direct. And that was part of the thing was like, you know, when I talk to a lot of students, I'm like, I want to act and I want to direct and I want to write. And I'm like, you can do all of that, but you can't do all of this sometimes at the same time. So I was kind of that same thing of like, well, I want to have like a couple feet in the directing thing. But at least for my journey, I'm not saying that's everybody's journey, but I at least had to like pick a lane initially, just so you can give that something more of your focus. Right. And so, so writing just became the thing that I could do. And in my heart, I'm always a writer, but directing was always something that I loved to do. And so obviously being able to do it on Insecure and on Cork was just like, certainly a natural extension of that, but something I always wanted to do. Mm-hmm.
Did Uncorked feel like, taking on a much bigger project because it's a feature rather than working with presumably new crew, new actors, everything?
100%. I mean, there were so many things that I was glad that I didn't direct Uncorked before I got to direct on Insecure. There were so many things I learned just watching a bunch of other directors who were great and like learning things and like just watching that process more. But a movie is its own animal, and I didn't know like what to expect in the beginning, but like by day two, like, cause I used to always hear like directors, like you'd hear about the director, you go like, oh, that director's like a jerk, he's an asshole. And I'd just be like, oh yeah, yelling. And then by the end, by day three, I was like, get that fucking thing over here. Like, let's go. Like, I don't have time to like, cause on a TV show, you're much more like collaborative. You're much more like, we're going to be back here. If we don't get it today, we can come back tomorrow. We can put it back in the schedule. When you're making a movie, it's like, I'm never coming back to this restaurant. This is it. So, and I've got 2 hours because I'm only going to have this actor for 8 days. So there's no more coming back to get this, right? This actor's got to go do another movie. So ways I would be much more tactful, a lot of that got chucked out of the way. And I was like, look, I'm trying to push this rock up the hill. You're either helping me or you're getting out of the way, but there's no like question about the debate of what we're doing. Like in TV show, you can be like, should we do this? Should we do this? Blah, blah. And in a movie, I was just like, oh yeah, no, it's a singular vision that just has to get done. Now we can collaborate ahead of time and we'll take that, but on the day and all that, no, we're not doing that. So it was just a much different beast, but I enjoyed it because I got to do things cinematically that like obviously Insecure, you know, Insecure has a sandbox and you can kind of go a little bit outside of that to try stuff, but you still have to, it's a show every week. You have to kind of play within the same thing, which, you know, we obviously tried to continue just to elevate, but on a movie, I could just be like, oh, I'm not shooting coverage. I'm just shooting this as a one, or I'm shooting this way, or I'm like going to shoot this in silhouette or do these things that like normally I don't get a chance to like play with cinematically and try. And so I got to do that. But what I learned on Insecure too was like how to take something that's small and making it feel cinematic, because that was always my challenge on Uncorked, was like, how do I make this little movie about like wine and barbecue in like Memphis, Tennessee, just feel bigger than what it is? And so that was a lot of things I learned there. I did get to apply and take more chances, right? So that was my thing, was like, I was like, I don't know if I'll get another movie. So I'm gonna take the most chances I wanna take and let it be very me. Whereas like you said, Insecure, even though I'm running the show, it's still in the voice of the show. And this was my first thing to be like, it doesn't have to be in the voice of the show or any other person's voice but mine. So that was a big driver of like, I'm going to just leave it all on the table in terms of that. And I've been really surprised at like how much that movie has yielded opportunities of like directing more because it's not it's not a movie that you would say on its face is like, oh, that's like, a, you know, oh, that's a thing.
Right. It's not flashy in the way you expect it to. Like, you're not.
It doesn't have all the things that like white people like in black movies critically. You know, it's like there's no pain, there's no trauma, there's no there's you know, it's just a slice of life. It was like when I was like modeling the movie, I was like, it should feel like very like Lady Bird, very like slice. Like, this is a Tuesday for this family. This is like, this isn't a very special day. It's just like a regular slice of life day, you know, like Manchester by the Sea and things like that.
Yeah. And I think that's what people are responding to. It's like, you knew what you wanted this to be and you executed that in a really deft way. And like, this is a guy who executed his vision. That's amazing.
Thank you.
And it goes down really easy. It's such a good movie. It's like it's, you know, it has all the stuff we want of life.
And you have great actors.
And I imagine.
And they have great actors. Yeah. So it's super absolutely easy.
And I imagine, you know, the opportunities coming out of that, coming out of Insecure, like, you're getting to chase the same thing that led you to Insecure in the first place, which was like getting to have fun, getting to try stuff, getting to work with good people. Yep.
It's been all that. All this stuff has been, you know, I was at first, it was interesting because I was like, oh my God, am I going to get like, here's a slave movie now. Like, we're queue up that. And it really hasn't. I really gotten like one of those. But most of them have been really like cool things or cool ideas. And it's just like figuring out like, okay, what's the right one that like fits into the time frame. And I wrote a movie for Netflix that's like a Christmas movie, kind of like in the vein of like the Santa Claus and Elf. Because I was like, black people never get to have like magic in their Christmas movies. It's always like a family, somebody's getting hit with a frying pan at Christmas. But like, white people get to be Elf and Santa. So I wanted to write something that was like super magical. So hopefully we'll know soon if that's going forward. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah, I feel like I read you talking about that movie. And I was like, oh my God, I've got to see this.
Yeah, it's super funny. Great. It's super funny. So I'm hoping.
Nice. Well, good luck. Meantime, season 5 of Insecure, I think as people are hearing this, will be out now.
Yeah.
And if you haven't, if for some reason someone hasn't watched the show, what are you waiting for? Now you can binge all 5 seasons. Watch it. It's
time
so good.
It's the perfect time. That's when I hopped in on Game of Thrones. I didn't watch Game of Thrones in the last season. I did Breaking Bad the same way. I was like, I felt like there was a window where I was like season 3 or 4 Game of Thrones where I was like, should I start? And I was just like, I won't know what's going. I was like, I gotta go. So I did. I just said, I'm gonna just wait to the end. And then I watched the whole, and it was fun because then I got to watch like 5 episodes in a night. You know, I could just go for it.
Exactly.
And I watched all of Game of Thrones in like 2 weeks.
Oh, good God. That'll mess you up. What are you watching these days? What's getting you excited? What's getting you inspired? What are you talking about with your family, with your friends?
With my friends, Succession, for sure. For sure. That's like my show. I love that show so much. I'm sure by the time this airs, I will have watched Squid Game. I just want people to calm down a little bit first before I like hop in. It's a lot of Squid Game stuff.
That's fair.
So I was like, all right, let's reel it in. But Succession for sure, absolutely. So good. And the way they play with tone is just so funny, so serious, so great performances.
Yeah. Are there things, you know, as you're working on a bunch of different projects, are there like movies and TV shows and things that you go back to as sort of touchstones, either to inspire upcoming stuff or just to like remind you why you love doing this?
For sure. And I think sometimes it depends on what the thing is, right? So like I'm working on a movie right now and like Moonlight and The Social Network, I've been watching like a ton of it again for different reasons. For Moonlight, I watch it for the simplicity of like needing less to say, like the realness of that movie and like letting things exist in the quiet. There are things in that movie that in the movie I'm writing that resonate with that. And then Social Network, just in the way the dialogue is so, when the dialogue does kick in, it's very just so sharp and like kind of quick and there, so I watch it sometimes for that, just for the like the way the world is created, which is so specific. So I've watched Social Network like 2 or 3 times again, and I've watched Moonlight like 5 times. So those for those specific movies, because sometimes I'm like, oh, how do I do this? Because the movie I'm writing is like about like horses in Compton, and so there's all kinds of like, not, and also like not wanting to write the tropey version, right, of like the things you expect. So the movie has a lot of things it's trying to get around by basis of like what you expect in those movies to happen. So it's like that. So it's like, oh, those movies, the things that I feel like in Moonlight, like even killing Mahershala Ali's character for this, for the second and third act, is like so smart to just allude to him who died. But and because he's only in the first 30 minutes of the movie, that's how, but he's amazing. But I just like, oh, they just made the world continue. Because I have a time jump as well. So I was like, oh, I love how they just like continue the world on, things have changed, and you just can get how from A to B, how this happened in the time you missed. Yeah. And especially obviously when he goes from being, you know, Ashton to being, you know, Electrovante, and he's much bigger, and you know, you can extrapolate how he got there too. So yeah. So those are the two movies I'm like really going back to a lot right now.
It makes sense. And I love, and I think we, you know, this comes up a lot on the show, is like, we take from this stuff. We get inspired from this stuff. We look at how the mechanics of it work, and then it goes through our filter.
Exactly.
And becomes, you know, our own thing, our own script.
Yep.
That sounds great. I can't wait to see what's up. Prentice, thanks so much for chatting. Come back anytime.
Absolutely. Thank you. Happy to be here. I hope I didn't suck too much. So I hope it was worth it.
Come on. No, that was great. Forever
Dog. This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.